Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
So we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
yeah, we sure did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful, fabulous, beautiful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song. We're back for another hour of incredibly profound, important, brilliant, funny, and enlightening talk with our fabulous string of guests. We got another great one today, Mark Shapiro, talking to us from the West Coast. Mark is the author of Carbon Shock and is an old-timer, a real veteran in the environmental movement, and has written many, many great things over the years. Carbon Shock is with Chelsea Green Publishers. Mark, are you with us?
I am. Good to be here,
and
Harvey.
Where are you? Well, where is here? Where are you in the universe here?
Here is Oakland, California.
Oakland, California. Is that your home of is that where you live?
That's where I live, yeah. I'm actually at home right now, which is where I work out of sometimes anyway.
Good for you.
Yeah, beautiful Oakland. Sunny here, great city of Oakland. And
well, listen, before we get into, you know, such piddling things like the climate and the survival of the human race, I want to talk to you about Oaksterdam in downtown Oakland. What has happened? I visited Oaksterdam University, founded by the incredible Richard Lee, the Institute, shall we say, of Higher Learning for Marijuana. And I know it's been harassed by federal authorities. What's going on there with this world's greatest university for the culture of cannabis? Do you know?
For the enlightenment. Actually, things are, I think, calming down a little bit, I believe. I mean, there's certainly not quite the intensity of the crackdown. I think there's been such an incredible efflorescence of marijuana efforts around the primarily around the West. Actually, you got Colorado, you got Washington, of course California, which actually did vote down oddly enough in a kind of a legalization effort about a year or two ago. But I don't believe
that tally, by the way, Mark. I watched that election. What year was it? Was it
that was like
2010?
Prop 15, wasn't it, or something? A couple of years ago.
Yeah, I don't think the marijuana referendum actually lost. I think that vote was manipulated, as was the gay. I believe the gay marriage one was too. But that's another topic. But I was concerned. So you say Oaksterdam is proceeding okay?
I think so. I mean, to be totally honest, I don't follow it that closely. I mean, you know, I have
you probably don't
great
remember.
Sympathy,
I mean,
for that,
you know.
But. But I don't. I haven't followed it like intimately. But I actually think there is a sense that the pressure is easing somewhat, and I think that actually Holder has actually sort of moved back a little bit from earlier extremely aggressive efforts, which kind of got a little insane for a couple of years. But I think that actually is kind of easing up here in Oakland.
Yeah, I hope so, and I really admire Richard Lee. I hope to have him on the show at some time. Do you know Richard Lee at all?
I don't.
Okay.
But I certainly know
of
him and stuff, and he's done.
He's a founder of Oaksterdam.
He's done a job of establishing these kind of basic principles of medical marijuana, which is pretty, you know, common in a state, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that marijuana, I am telling people that California will legalize marijuana by referendum in 2016. I can't imagine it going otherwise. Can you?
Not really. I think actually this is changing so profoundly, kind of like, you know, you put that together with gay marriage. I mean, it's like the sentiment in the public, at least, just seems to be palpably shifting, probably on both levels. And so I would say that basically, you know, there doesn't seem to be a huge change in behavior when it comes to anyway, when it comes to individuals and the weed. But obviously there are still laws governing it in the state. It hasn't reached a state of like the way Washington or Colorado have legitimized it on an economic level. I think ultimately the economic argument is going to be a very powerful one, since I think Colorado and Washington are showing that, number one, it's a way to kind of legitimate this, you know, the use of marijuana, but also to generate a lot of money for state coffers once it's kind of regulated. And that's, I think, starting to have an impact as well.
Yeah, and
obviously,
it also
this is not my topic of particular expertise, though. You know,
yeah,
I'm certainly aware of it living here in Oakland.
Well, it also lowers the cost of putting people in jail. So,
yes,
since you're in Oakland,
it's actually the I would say the one thing, and not, again, not being an expert on this, I don't write about this topic. I do follow it but I don't write about it. I'm not an expert. But the pressures on the California prison system have just been insane. I mean, the amount of people in prison for really minor and nonviolent drug-related crimes is like crazy. So I think that there are efforts to actually take the pressure off the penal system by kind of beginning to ease up on the kind of levels of prosecutions on at least nonviolent drug questions. But again, I'm not an expert on this, but I do get a sense that this is beginning to happen.
Yeah, me too. And, of course, it's interesting how the legalization of pot seems to parallel the legalization of gay marriage. There are just about the same number of states where you have medical marijuana and legal gay marriage, although I guess the Supreme Court decision now has really opened the floodgates on gay marriage, and I wish they'd do something parallel with medical and other forms of marijuana. It would be a great relief. Okay, Mark, so let's talk about what you really do know. You are a very important leading expert and very important writer on the question of climate change and the politics behind it. Your book, Carbon Shock. Tell us about Carbon Shock and why you wrote it and what the really main points are.
Yeah, well, thanks, Harvey. As you know, I've been kind of writing about environmental questions for a long time, decades now. I can actually say decades, which is kind of incredible. And I really wanted to basically understand. I've actually been interested in writing over the years about the economic questions that are linked to environmental questions, because I think the economics is often the part that is neglected by both the mainstream press and even the alternative press, you could say, sort of neglects this very powerful economic component to the discussion. And my book is called Carbon Shock. It just came out, and that title is very consciously chosen. I mean, I think actually because the shock that is actually climate change is delivering to our sort of natural system has its corollary in the shock it's delivering to our economic system. And so I wrote a book about the economic shock that climate change signifies that essentially arises out of the kind of natural shock to the system. And I guess the fundamental motive that I had was that the way we approach fossil fuels, the way that fossil fuels are thought about and are treated, has to do with a fundamental illusion that we're operating under, which is essentially that fossil fuels are less expensive than renewables. And if you look at the debate over and over and over again, it's like, what's it going to cost to actually green the grid, to actually rely more heavily on renewables versus fossil fuels, and the cost that that's going to basically cost us as individuals and also cost our government. And this is basically essentially part of the debate, the expensiveness of moving towards a more renewably based energy grid. And I think that that's actually based on a fundamental illusion, which is what I write about in the book, that essentially fossil fuels are cheaper and the notion that they're significantly cheaper. And as I point out in the book, in case after case after case, we are actually paying huge costs for our reliance on fossil fuels. It's just that they are not linked to our actual consumption of those fuels. The costs have been essentially externalized. And when we say externalized costs, which is a very economic term, it comes out of economics, this is not an abstract idea, though. It means an externalized cost is something that we, society, pays that are not paid by the people or the entities that cause the costs. And so in time after time after time, you see that actually fossil fuels are artificially have an artificial price that actually does not reflect their actual costs. And you can look across the board at the rising level of those costs to us, the society, to the broader people, to taxpayers. We bear the costs. Fossil fuel companies make the profits. And I think it's time to start facing up to that fundamental illusion and to enable us to essentially start making more accurate and honest decisions about how we move forward. So that's one of the main reasons I wrote the book, was to kind of probe into that illusion and tell stories about, or basically go around the world, which is what I did, to actually try to understand how those externalized costs are being experienced and paid for and fought over now.
So in a certain sense, to make it ridiculously simplistic, there's a serious gap between price, in other words, what we pay and what we're charged in the marketplace for carbon fuels, and what they actually cost us in terms of our existence on this planet. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you a little example. There's like countless examples, and in the book, of course, I go to different places in the world. I go to the farms of California to show what the consequences are of fossil fuel use on growing food and how we pay those costs. And then I go to the Amazon rainforest and talk about the effects on the rainforest and the effort to preserve those trees and incredible economic consequences in rainforest. And I go to different cities around the world, including actually Pittsburgh in the United States and Manchester in the UK, too. Heavily industrialized cities that are now trying to make the shift to a green economy and how that plays out economically speaking. And so to give
I'm going to want you to, we've got a full hour here, so I'm going to want you to talk about some of those examples, a lot of them actually, as we proceed. But in terms of the bigger picture, essentially what you're saying is we're not paying, and of course the corporations aren't paying, for what it really costs us in terms of health, economic well-being in the long term, and planetary survival. We're really not paying the price to match the cost. Is that a fair way of saying it?
Yeah, that's a good way to say it. I mean, we could start at the level of public health. So, for example, as we all know, that one of the impacts of climate change is that the Earth is warming and sea levels are rising. But one consequence of the Earth warming is that actually diseases that used to be concentrated in the sort of equatorial zone are actually moving northward. So there are actually diseases now appearing, for example, in the American Southwest that are impacting both cattle, valley fever and other things like that that actually are impacting cattle, and human beings who are actually, the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, is now have a special office to deal with the public health impacts of climate change because different kind of diseases are showing up, particularly in the American Southwest and in the southern part of the West, that previously were limited to Central America and Mexico. And so where do the costs come from? Well, that's paid for by the Center for Disease Control, which has to do an entire new set of research, trying to come up with treatment systems, public health authority in those areas, trying to deal with the emergence of diseases that they had never seen before.
And, are you going to include Ebola as part of the
No, I'm not going to include Ebola. Actually, I am definitely not going to include Ebola because that is particularly a disease, at least it starts in Western Africa and the particular conditions there. I don't want to get into Ebola because that is the number one. It's too frightening.
Okay,
and
so tell us then about some of the diseases among human beings.
Well, like Valley Fever, for example, which is a disease that's carried in dust. And particularly in hot, dry climates, that has been actually far more prominent in sort of Mexico and northern Mexico, particularly dry deserts of northern Mexico, that is actually beginning to move into southern Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, even southern parts of California. And they're finding that actually people are coming into emergency rooms with these conditions, and they're finding that this disease, which had previously not been very prominent at all in the United States, is beginning to respond to the much hotter conditions here in the United States that have been a result of climate change. So you also, and that's actually people, when it comes to plants, for example, our food crops and everything, they're finding certain bugs that are moving northward from Central America, Mexico, accustomed to that kind of very dry climate in those parts of this continent, moving into, for example, potatoes. I mean, they're actually, weirdly enough, bugs that had been quite prominent in the fields in Mexico and Central America now being found in some of the potato fields in Southern California, which means that essentially you've got agronomists running around who are having to deal with an entirely new bug that they hadn't had to deal with before and how to protect against it, which leads to either two things. One is application of more chemicals, which we know is probably not a good idea in the broad sense of the term, but nevertheless, the application of more and different pesticides, or a more aggressive way to kind of come up with varieties that are more resistant to that particular bug. But the question here when we talk about this is who pays for that? So we pay for that in the terms of agronomic research, in terms of the kind of research that's being done to combat that kind of particular pest when it comes to agriculture or when it comes to the public health consequence of things like Valley Fever. Who pays for that? Well, we do. And that is one little tiny portion of what we talk about when we talk about Anyway, we had a tour. There was a couple of some of us, about 15 or 20 of us, went on a tour sponsored by the Army Corps of Engineers on the new levee system being built to protect New Orleans from the next set of hurricanes, ideally so that New Orleans doesn't get inundated during the next Katrina-like hurricanes, which, of course, are coming more rapidly and more intensively due to climate change, according to many, many scientific studies and our own NASA and NOAA and various U.S. government agencies. So basically, this new kind of surge barriers and barriers they're putting along all that delta area in New Orleans are pretty impressive. And if you look at them, they're pretty impressive. Needed partly, of course, because they've decimated the wetlands down there, which are kind of natural flood control areas or techniques. But this new levee system has cost essentially $14 billion. So if you look at what it's needed to protect New Orleans, God knows, deserving of all the protection we can give to that wonderful city. But if you actually begin to understand that a significant portion of that $14 billion to build up those levees again is attributable to the intensity of those storms that are coming from climate change, you can begin to understand how this kind of concept of externalized cost plays itself out. Of course, now New York, of course, is buttressing its own set of defenses to the rising sea and the next set of hurricanes that's going to come after Sandy, and North Carolina, other states starting to do the same. So actually, and what's interesting because I continue to follow this, in addition to having written about it in the book, is FEMA, the disaster agency of the federal government. And I just tweeted this, believe it or not. I've actually gotten on Twitter recently, because FEMA has actually just determined that states, in order to obtain federal emergency money, must begin coming up with survival strategies for related to climate change. So for the first time, the federal government itself and the Emergency Management Agency of the federal government is demanding that states develop emergency preparations related to climate, right? So
yeah.
This is an enormous change in the federal government requirements and is an indication of how much money it's costing the federal government to excuse me, I'm on the radio. Okay. So, sorry, somebody just opened the door. It's live time here, live action. So my point is essentially that who pays for these developments, and we do. So when we understand what the externalized costs of climate change, how they actually are exercised and how we experience them, then we begin to see fossil fuels in an entirely different way.
Okay, so we're talking with Mark Shapiro, author of Carbon Shock. And Mark, what you're saying, published by Chelsea Green. Mark, you're saying basically that when we burn fossil fuels, it unbalances the climate, makes things hotter, creates things like epidemics among people and animals, also creates hurricanes that threaten cities. We have to pay the money to protect our cities and to deal with the crises that the health crises,
right?
And therefore, but the corporations that burn these fossil fuels, they don't pay any of that.
Exactly. And that's why we've been operating under this essentially illusion. We are paying the cost for the collateral damage caused by fossil fuels. So this is a very important thing to understand. Obviously, we all, in a way, obviously we benefit from fossil fuel. Let's face it. All of us are beneficiaries of the use of fossil fuels. We drive our cars. We, you know, to varying degrees, of course, we try to limit our carbon footprints, but basically all of us are kind of beneficiaries of this system. That's basically the fact. So the question is, though, we have not till now been paying the actual cost of those, of our use of this fuel, which actually gives us a distorted understanding of how to make the decision about how many public resources we put into renewable energy sources like solar and wind, which whatever they do not have the collateral environmentally corrosive effects that fossil fuels have. So we've been operating under kind of an illusion in a sense that we're not paying the cost of fossil, the full cost, when in fact we are. And that's what I set about to actually demonstrate in the book through the places around the world who are facing these costs very directly. So it's,
and of course, we also, the price of, or rather the cost of the military action that's taken to protect our so-called access, at least to the fuel in the Middle East, that's not taken into account either.
Well, actually, what's interesting is the U.S. military is actually one of the most advanced and sophisticated in researching ways to decrease our reliance on fossil fuels. And they come at it, and it's a kind of something I actually learned in the process of doing the book, because I certainly didn't expect it. But then I, in getting deeper and deeper into it, I realized there are a number of things that are happening in the U.S. military that are actually pretty interesting. Number one, our own Department of Defense has said explicitly that climate change presents a long-term national security threat to the United States because of the incredible impact it's having on parts of the world that border the United States that that are getting less and less stable because people are being forced to leave the land that they live on because of a crisis with water and extreme weather event, and are displaced from the land and therefore put a lot of pressure on the migration services in the United States. They've also identified U.S. military installations that are being threatened by the rising seas. Needless to say, for those of your listeners who live in Virginia and North Carolina, I think they've actually seen that already, the challenge that the sea presents to U.S. naval installations. And the third thing is interesting when the military comes in is the volatility of the price of oil. And the military, if anybody, is very aware of what it costs to actually fuel all those planes and trucks and machines on oil, because it's got this incredibly long supply chain. So the U.S. military has actually been at the forefront of trying to do research into alternative fuels in order to, number one, reduce the price volatility that happens in the oil markets. Two, relying on kind of, in some cases, unfriendly sources of oil. The Europeans have definitely seen this when it comes to Russia. They've been doing everything they can to reduce their reliance on Russian oil.
Right, including marching into Ukraine and trying to take over their fracking fields.
Yes.
But so go ahead.
I know you just kind of have mentioned the military, but I do think it's very interesting to actually think of how the military looks things, which if they don't do anything else, they're not an overly sentimental view of the world. They have a pretty harsh, cool-eyed, realpolitik sense of the world, and as well as national security questions, as well as economics. And some of the most interesting research now being done on renewable fuels is being done by the U.S. military, because they perceive these kind of multiple threats from the existing fossil fuel system.
We're talking with Mark Shapiro, author of Carbon Shock, which has been published very recently by Chelsea Green Publishers. Mark is talking to us from Oakland, California. He is a veteran of the discussion. And we really need to get a hold now of what's happening with fracking and with natural gas. There seems to be a huge transition going on in the carbon industry away from coal and oil and into fracking and natural gas. Can you talk a bit about that transition, Mark Shapiro?
Yeah. I mean, there's an enormous effort to to extract from extremely, aggressive churning up of the earth to obtain the oil that lies, beneath the earth in levels of rock. Fracking, of course, is an extremely violent activity in terms of blowing up the earth and then trying to extract the oil that comes from that. That's the oil part of the picture. There's the natural gas part of the picture, which also has a similar kind of process. And essentially the debate now gets around to the fact is natural gas a truly more environmentally friendly technology than oil or coal? And there are, I suppose, two parts of the answer to that question. I don't claim to have the last word on this, but I do think it's interesting. That kind of fracking that is done to obtain natural gas, the kind of techniques that are being used to obtain natural gas, number one, it's not always as aggressive as it is with the fracking that's used to obtain natural gas, but the question now is essentially how greenhouse gas friendly is natural gas, And natural gas, broadly speaking, emits about half the greenhouse gases of oil and coal. So the question now is, with all the effort it takes to obtain that natural gas, are we diverting our efforts from more substantively investing in oil and solar and wind and other technologies that clearly have, you know, a very close to zero greenhouse gas effect? Or do we commit ourselves to this kind of, quote, bridge fuel, which is what the natural gas is being seen as, although there are many indications that it's not quite as clean as it's often presented to be? A very important decision today, actually, by the European Union, literally just got it off the wire about an hour ago, which was essentially that the EU has decided in its effort, it has a system of grading various fuels according to their greenhouse gas contributions, and has decided not to treat the oil that comes from fracking differently than it does from normal oil, in which case, which is a step backwards, actually, from those who actually see fracking and such as a greenhouse gas intensive activity.
All right, let's take it up there, Mark Shapiro.
I mean, fracking has obviously made the United States more self-reliant when it comes to energy, when it comes to fossil fuels, and actually probably made the struggle a little more difficult in the United States, because it's actually given us a domestic source of oil.
Well, Mark Shapiro, let's jump in right there. I'm going to take a break. When we come back in 3 minutes, we're going to talk about something we haven't touched on yet, which is nuclear power. We also want to talk about the march, the recent march in New York City, and then I want to get even deeper. You're truly a world resource on this discussion about fracking, methane, and its role in global warming. We're going to come back with Mark Shapiro and Carbon Shock in 3 minutes, but we are now going to hear my good buddy Dana Lyons with the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. Be right back.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Sweet home to me, Solartopia, that's the future for me, green powered energy, windmills, hydrogen, photovoltaic cells with solar panels everywhere, solar cars, fast trains, bicycles, hydroplanes, get you home in under an hour.
That's my buddy Dana Lyons, also famous for Cows with Guns, the anthem, or the latest anthem, I think the top-ranking anthem of the vegan movement. Wonderful, wonderful video. I think it's had over 2 million hits now on YouTube, Cows with Guns. Take a look if you haven't seen it. We are with Mark Shapiro, an ideal radio guest. Mark, you have a great voice for radio. I have a great face for radio, so we make a good team here. And we're talking about your book, Carbon Shock, published by Chelsea Green. The debate over natural gas, fracked natural gas, and fracking is really a new player on the scene. And, yeah, you know, it seems to me to have apocalyptic impacts on the planet. For God's sakes, they go down there, they blow up the shale, they pour all this water in, they destroy the water tables. I mean, it seems to me like this is a recipe for ecological suicide. Is it as bad as that?
Well, first of all, we do need to distinguish between natural gas as it's traditionally been obtained, which, you know, it is a fossil fuel, but there are ways to obtain natural gas in a way that's less ecologically violent. But this new phenomenon, like you've said, you're correct that this new idea of getting access to new pools of natural gas is pretty violent, and it involves really essentially blasting the earth and then extracting the gas from the sort of layers of rock. You know, yes, it is a pretty intensive, well, it has a number of different effects. Number one, and there's been a big debate about this in California, it needs massive amounts of water because essentially what you're doing is blasting the earth with huge quantities of water that you need in order to obtain the gas. And then the question is, what do you do with all that wastewater? And the question is, you know, it shows you actually another one of the impacts of climate change at a time when we are already, when climate change is creating enormous stresses on the global water system. And when we say that, we're talking about the patterns of precipitation that are both, we saw that happen in the United States across the Midwest and California, unprecedented record-breaking droughts, both in this state and also in the Midwest. So upon this already strained water system, you are throwing in fracking, which has the potential to both utilize water that otherwise would be used to nourish food and nourish human beings. So you're diverting water for this purpose of breaking up the earth, and you're also sending poisoned water back into kind of wellsprings of, you know, pools, which have the potential to poison existing water supplies. And there are a lot of the farm community here in California, the actually wine community, very nervous about the effects of fracking here in the state of California, and I think elsewhere in the country. So this is
a huge
especially question.
In the middle of a drought, for God's sakes.
Yeah, I mean in the middle of a drought, it shows you actually the how climate change changes the calculations. So already we would have some concerns about the effects of fracking on the water supply. Already, whether we had climate change or not, it would be a legitimate concern. But when you add the disruption that climate change is causing to the water system, the existing supplies of water, it adds a serious extra level of concern as to what the impact and the long-term impact of fracking is and just talking about the water. The other major concern from a greenhouse gas perspective is that while yes, natural gas itself has about 50%, about half the greenhouse gas impact as other fossil fuels do. However, the gas that does come out of natural gas is essentially methane because it comes from underneath the earth, and methane that escapes, and actually they've found that in a lot of the fracking operations, a huge amount of methane escapes from the process, is a far more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, and enormously more potent as a greenhouse gas disruptor in the atmosphere. And so the question of natural gas obtained through the kind of fracking that we're talking about as a kind of a bridge fuel is really questionable, since the process of obtaining it is so violent and disruptive itself. And I think that's something that we have to think about.
All right, now, speaking
going forward,
of violent and disruptive, Mark Shapiro, yeah. Where does nuclear power fit into all this?
Oh, boy. Hey, listen, Harvey, you could probably tell us as much as I could about that. I know you. This has been a deep interest of yours for many, many years. all I can add to the question about nuclear power, which I do not really talk about in Carbon Shock, is the question that the presumption somehow is out there that nuclear power can somehow be a, quote, clean and a low-carbon alternative to fossil fuels, I think is something that really has to be examined very powerfully, number one, on the first level, because the amount of energy it takes to actually build a nuclear power plant and ensure that it's actually going to be safe, quote, unquote, is a huge expenditure of greenhouse gases. So that alone is a serious concern. Then all the questions of security and, God knows, the waste generated by nuclear power plants has really not even been solved. They're still battling over where they're going to put the existing amounts of nuclear waste in the United States. Nobody wants to take that waste, that very dangerous, radioactive waste. So the question of nuclear power as being a kind of a low-carbon alternative comes with such a huge number of questions, which I'm sure you're quite familiar with too, Harvey, that I think to think of it as an easy solution to the greenhouse gas situation that we're in is really a deeply flawed assumption.
Okay, so let's take the opposite now. Tell us about renewables. How realistic is it? Of course, you're on the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show here, but how realistic really are we in thinking that renewables can, I don't know if solve is too strong a word, but get us in the right direction on climate change, with solar and wind? Is this pipe dream stuff, or are we seeing real results?
Well, number one, I don't think, I'm not a utopian in this area, and I'm pretty actually, I try to actually hew pretty closely to the mechanisms that exist and are shown to work, and I'm actually stay pretty close to where the world is and trying to figure out, number one, what kind of illusions that we have that are holding us back, which is partly what the book is about, and then seeing where the promise lies. And I think that there is enormous promise that has not been exploited yet when it comes to renewables. I don't think they're the whole answer, because probably the very real true thing is not that the entire world can run on solar and wind, because conditions are so different and et cetera, et cetera. But we're nowhere near the place where we are making maximum use of renewable energy, wind and solar being the most popular, but also there's enormous amount of interesting research being done on biofuels and things that are non-food products that can be turned into biofuels. As well as kind of renewable energy sources that don't have anywhere near the kind of collateral damage that fossil fuels have. So the question is that will, to basically start using renewables on a kind of a very, very large scale or magnified level from what they are now, does take some investment of public resources. And to basically, one, increase the sophistication and agility of those kind of fuels, and to produce them on such a scale that the price actually really does start to come down. And so in terms of making those decisions, we need to start actually looking at how much we are already paying to support essentially the fossil fuel companies, both through direct subsidies. I mean, it's like it defies logic that we're still giving $4 to $5 billion a year to the oil and gas industries in kind of old phantom subsidies left over from the early part of the 20th century. And those, needless to say, would be far better spent actually helping to do further research on solar and wind energy. But when we're talking about research, we already know that they work, right? So the question now is how to actually apply them, apply that kind of technology on a mass scale, which has to do with, developing a grid system that can integrate this kind of technology. Fights are being breaking out all over the United States and Arizona, California, other parts of the country in terms of developing grids that can actually take solar or wind generated power and send them back into the existing grid. And there's a lot more work that can be done on that. I think it is pie in the sky to think that this is the entire solution is going to come, that the entire world is going to be running on some happy harmony of, you know, turning windmills and solar panels. I think that is not going to be the case, but the question now is how the percentages by which we can reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. If you look at a country like Germany, for example, very highly, needless to say, extremely sophisticated economy, one of the top, I think, five economies in the world.
Yeah, they're number
easily
four.
Comparable to the United States. There are entire periods of time when Germany relies for half of its energy on a combination of wind and solar. And if we can start aspiring at least to that level, we will begin to see kind of a reduction in the greenhouse gases.
Okay, we're talking with Mark Shapiro, author of Carbon Shock, available from Chelsea Green. Mark, I am going to disagree with you. I do think that the world will run entirely on renewables at some point in time. The tendency of renewables seems to be very strongly to come in under budget and ahead of schedule, and Germany seems to be proving that true. We also have the dynamic of the ability to decentralize our energy economy, and that's a big deal. I know you've talked about that in the past. Tell us some of the political implications of fossil fuels versus the renewables, if you would.
Well, the political we've been living through the political implications where we have a completely frozen, you know, political system, frozen by the few political figures who actually are so directly beholden to the fossil fuel industries that they are starting to look more and more and more archaic. I mean, in a way, the U.S. political system has been completely frozen by political leaders who are in many ways even behind the economic, even behind many of the major companies in the United States. I mean, if you look at the major food processors who are expressing great anxiety about the supply chains of delivering the cereals and grains they need for the, you know, large amounts of food they process, aside from whether or not that's good for you, which is a whole other discussion. But if you look at some of the massive food processors, they are beginning to talk about major concerns over how the reliability of the cereals and grains that come to them, that they need to do major food production. And even if you look at the major oil companies, are even beginning, the companies that certainly have been the primary companies responsible for the situation we're in now with fossil fuels, they too are acknowledging the existence of climate change. And actually, I quote in the book, believe it or not, astoundingly enough, from the websites of Exxon and Chevron and other BP and other major oil companies, which acknowledge explicitly that fossil fuels have contributed to this phenomenon known as climate change. Of course, they don't talk about what they would do about it, but the recognition of climate change is pretty much across the board here in the United States, except for a very small group of congressmen, Republican members of Congress, who have continued to basically block any moves towards renewable energy. And I think what's interesting is it's like you've got this leftover, you know, you've had a 200 years of since the Industrial Revolution, right? And it took us, going back to the early part of the 19th century, and it took basically in the UK and then the United States followed, it took, let's say, about 50 years before the acute effects of reliance on fossil fuels began to be recognized, right? It took Charles Dickens and other great writers and also journalists of that time in the mid-19th century to start identifying the impact that coal and oil had on the skies and the health of people who breathed all that soot, and took another number of years to begin to actually restrain the acute effects of fossil fuel pollution. Now it's taken, you know, let's face it, it's taken about 175 years from the onset of fossil fuels to, we're talking getting into the 1980s, let's say. There were some in the 1970s, but say the 1980s, scientists begin to understand what the impacts are of fossil fuels on the atmospheric balance, right? And they start seeing that, oh my God, these things called greenhouse gases are really causing immense turmoil in the atmosphere and causing these huge changes that we're now seeing, you know, beginning to roll through the planet. And that has really been in the last 25 or 30 years. And those fossil fuel companies that are responsible for these changes, number one, are holding on as hard as they can to a change that they know is coming. They know
yes.
it's coming.
And, yeah. And they're resisting. Mark Shapiro, author of Carbon Shock here, were you at the march in New York? And since you deal with these issues so deeply, you are one of the veterans, veteran journalists and experts on the carbon situation in our atmosphere and our economy. How do you read the impact of what just happened in New York? And we're actually getting down to it, so... let's hear what you got to say about the movement side. How effective are we being in fighting the carbon industry, and what do you think the march's impact will be?
Well, I think the march impact is actually huge, actually. You had several hundred thousand people in New York. You had millions of people around the world demanding that the governments act on climate change. So the atmosphere around climate change, to use the word, has changed, actually, significantly, in that the movement is putting huge pressure on political leaders. I think Obama has certainly heard from the movement and the kind of measures he's taken to, within this constrained kind of idiot freezing of the congressional system, has nevertheless tried to put new emission limits on, or has put new emission limits on, coal-fired power plants. I think that does spell the end of coal. Deal with the displacement that that creates in coal country, which it does do. And when we talk about public resources shifting away from our subsidies, which we have been doing, that's the point of my book, is to illustrate we have been subsidizing essentially the fossil fuel industries for all these years. And so now it's time to start shifting our subsidies of fossil fuel industries to deal with the, number one, the people who are dislocated by our moves away from fossil fuels, and that includes people who have had to rely on coal for their livelihood. So number one, Obama certainly has heard the calls from the movement. Number two, what's interesting and a revelation to me is I did a story recently about the actually it was in Yale 360 about a week ago about the fossil fuel companies' own price for carbon, and even Exxon and Chevron and those other companies have a price that they use internally for accounting purposes of a price for carbon, and they too are hearing the public call, because the more intense the pressure gets to act on carbon, guess what? The higher the carbon price goes within the internal accounting mechanisms of the oil companies, who see the threat of action. And when they see the threat of action, they begin to account for that in their internal accounting. So it, of all the places that those protesters were heard, probably the last that they imagined being heard at was in the halls of Exxon and Chevron, but that was, they were listening, as were the, and I wrote about this in Yale 360 about a week ago. They heard that pressure. So I think that there's no question that the movement is having an impact. Whether it's going to be fast enough, I mean, now we're in a state of, like, how quick are we going to move? Moves are happening, and we are beginning to shift away from our reliance on fossil fuels. We will find out over the next year or so how fast that's going to be. I think there's no question that the shift is beginning to happen. And the question is, how long does this kind of fossil fuel dominion last? And that really is the question now. And so the pressure, I think, has to be maintained. And to do so, and I try to offer the economic argument in my book, Carbon Shock, of the economic argument for this shift, which is actually very important, as as important, I think, as the profound moral arguments and such that are in terms of climate change, in terms of the world we pass on to the next generation. What are the economics that we are facing now that argue for this shift away from fossil fuels?
Well, okay, Mark Shapiro, I have an image of accountants now in the carbon industry calculating the dollar cost to them of each person marching in the march. Is that probably accurate, isn't it?
Well, broadly speaking, poetically speaking, Harvey, which you're allowed to do, but poetically speaking, yes. I mean, and what I mean by that is that when you talk to oil company executive, which I have done, and to actually understand how they're beginning to account for the risk from climate change, they're beginning to give a cost to carbon in their internal accounting. And part of how that cost is calculated is both what the government does to begin to restrain carbon emissions, but it also has to do with how loud the public pressure and demand is for action, which from an oil company point of view is a measurement of risk. And that's what we're talking about.
But we're down to the nitty gritty here then. What is the biggest barrier to getting us off carbon fuels? And by the way, just for your interest, nuclear power plants do emit carbon-14. They are not entirely carbon-free. And I'm sure you knew that, but I want our listeners to know that. And
you're the man. You're the man to clarify that, Harvey. There's no question about it.
But it's okay. But the question now is, in the last minute or two here, how do we make this transition? Does carbon shock give us a prescription for action?
Well, it does, actually, and I tried to illustrate that in the book in all these different ways, because there are multiple ways into this question of how we start moving. But I think what we need to do is start giving a price, assigning a price to carbon that reflects its actual cost. That's step one.
And you support a carbon tax, I assume.
Yes, and once we do that, then we can start making honest decisions about how we allocate the public resources that we have. I think that cost has to come with a provision to ensure that the primary burden of those costs does not fall on people with the least resources to pay for that, and that the fossil fuel companies need to bear a significant portion of that burden. And you have ideas such as tax and dividend, in which you would tax carbon and based on its greenhouse gas emissions. And then a portion of those revenues would then be returned to citizens through tax mechanisms.
And I assume that to citizens who buy solar panels. Mark Shapiro, you have been a great guest. You are very articulate. Your book, A Carbon Shock, obviously an important addition to the literature, from Chelsea Green. Mark, thanks so much for being with us this hour, which just flew by, as always, with a brilliant guest. Hope to have you back sometime. The book is Carbon Shock, from Chelsea Green. Mark Shapiro, hope to have you back someday soon, okay?
Hey, thanks a lot. Great talking to you.
My pleasure. Thank you. This has been another scintillating hour of the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thanks to the crew in New York and to the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be back next week with another show on how to save our planet. See you then.
So we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know we're gonna